Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now the latest installment of our open phone series, The Explanatarium. That's right, Explanatarium, a magical radio space where the lights go low and complicated things get explained in plain language by you, the crowd. So we're opening up the phones for you to explain something, anything, to your fellow WNYC listeners. If you just get something, or mostly if you're educated in something, truly expert in something that most other people find complicated, call us up to explain. If you think you can explain something complicated or often misunderstood, and we ask you to do it in 60 seconds or less so people don't go on and on, enlighten us. The phones are open. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this can be about anything. You know where your area of particular expertise lies. In previous installments of the Explanatarium, we've had listeners explain the difference between halogen and incandescent light bulbs. We had a caller explain common misconceptions about the Protestant Reformation. One of our favorites was a caller who explained how the air conditioning system on the subways works. So if you can explain something, anything, clearly and simply, now's your time to shine. Perhaps you overhear people commonly misunderstand something in the news or about our city, and you just want to tap them on the shoulder and say, no, let me explain. Well, this is your moment to shine. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And there are only two rules in the Brian Lehrer Show Explanatarium. One, you have to do it in under a minute. And two, we ask for no heavy opinion, no political rants. We have plenty of other segments for those. Just compelling information here and succinct clarification. All right? Also, keep your feet off the chair and please turn your cell phones off unless you're calling us. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Should I give you one example? Because we figure we should come to the table ready to play if we're asking you to do this. We looked up the difference between an alligator and a crocodile. Do you know the difference between an alligator and a crocodile? Well, it turns out the easiest way of telling apart crocodiles from alligators is to look at their noses. Alligators and caimans have a wide U-shaped rounded snout like a shovel, whereas crocodiles tend to have longer and more pointed V-shaped noses. If you're brave enough to get this close, with alligators, you can only see the top teeth when its mouth is closed, as opposed to all of a crocodile's teeth. Crocodiles can live in either fresh or salt water. While alligators are freshwater only, they lack the glands to filter out all the salt, so their time in salt or brackish water is limited. And as a result, what they eat differs significantly. In salt water, there is larger prey, which means the crocodiles have stronger jaws and are generally more aggressive. So it sounds like you'd rather run into an alligator if you have to run into one in a dark alley or a canal in Florida somewhere. And there's our submission to the Explanatarium today, the difference or some of the differences between alligators and crocodiles. What's yours? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We will enter the Explanatarium with your calls on Who Knows What after the break. WNYC, and it's the latest installment of our call-in series, The Explanatarium, the magical radio space where the lights go low and complicated things get explained in plain language by you. What are you expert in that you would like to take under 60 seconds, because that's the only real rule, to explain to everyone else? 212-433-WNYC. Our lines are full, so as people finish up, you can get in with a minute of your area of expertise. And we're going to start with Carol, calling all the way from Kansas. Kansas, Carol?
Hi, I'm Brian.
Hi. Where in Kansas? It's a big place.
I'm in Lawrence, Kansas, where the Lawrence, University of Kansas
University
is.
Of Kansas. I've been there.
Uh-huh.
And
yep.
Did you come from New York originally?
Well, not but I lived there for 10 years, and I just moved here in 2011 when I graduated from Columbia and got a job here. And so, you know, I'm in academia, so I go where the job is.
And old radio habits die hard.
Yes, so, I listen to WNYC on my phone, and I am a sustaining member still, even in Kansas.
Yay, thank you. Okay, what do you want to explain?
The difference between ESL and EFL, because I'm asked that all the time. And when I tell people what I do, I teach English as a second language. I teach ESL at the University of Kansas. And they ask me, what is that? And what is the difference between TESOL and TEFL? So ESL, English as a second language, is taught in countries where English is the primary language. So when students come, my students come from everywhere. They are living in the United States. And in my classroom, they study English. And also when they leave the classroom, they are exposed to English. They're bombarded with it. They're using it everywhere. And they're encountering it everywhere. ESL is English as a foreign language taught in another country where English is not spoken. When I lived in Japan, I taught English as a foreign language to Japanese people who only encountered English in my classroom and then left it and spoke Japanese.
So in either case, it would be the student's second language, but it's called ESL, English as a second language, for people who are here or in other English-speaking countries, and EFL, English as a foreign language, if you're in your home country where they don't speak English primarily.
And this lingo, this jargon, is also used for other languages. Some people teach FFL, French as a foreign language, or Spanish as a foreign language if they teach it in America. And if you're in a country where French or Spanish is spoken, then you're teaching that language as a second language. And the same goes for the certifications, TESOL and TEFL, teaching English as a second language and teaching English as a foreign language. That degree, that's what that's in. And then my degree from Columbia is in TESOL, teaching English to speakers of other languages, which encompasses both.
And in parts of America, they teach NFL, football, as your primary language.
This is correct, especially in Texas.
Carol, thank you very much. Naomi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Naomi.
Hi. Brian, I'm a longtime New York City resident, and people complain all the time about the buses. And they say, why do they have to stack up like that? You know, one is full and the next two are right behind it. There's a reason for that, and they will never, ever have a solution. And that is because there's no control over the number of people getting on or off. So if you start out with the buses evenly paced from the terminal, one heads out, they get a whole bunch of people, the next one heads out, and is timed, but there's only a few people at the next stop. Eventually, they kind of like a traffic jam, the accordion. And so it's always going to be like that.
Interesting. But assuming that you're right about why it happens, why couldn't they space the buses differently so that instead of leaving the terminal at even intervals, they leave in some other interval that somebody could design that would reflect and compensate for that pattern? Do you ever ask yourself that?
Well, no, I suppose they could figure out an algorithm for that, but I don't know if that's always predictable. I guess they could do it especially around school pick up and drop off times. Seems to me that there's always going to be maybe a wheelchair somewhere along the line that holds up a bus.
They get on much quicker than they used to. We learned on the show the other day since they went to the front door loading of the wheelchair instead of the back door. But
okay.
What's your bus? Do you have a bus?
Yeah, I love my bus. It's a 63 on Fifth Avenue. And I want to put in a word for that app that you can look at to see when it's coming. It makes a huge difference.
Naomi, thanks so much. By the way, one of our producers reports that even on the select bus service on Nostrand Avenue in Brooklyn, intended to move super fast, this still happens. Vane in Beacon, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Vane.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
What do you want to explain?
I'm going to try to tell you about deep geothermal energy. Most people, when we hear geothermal, we think housing or commercial buildings being heated and cooled by heat pumps. Deep geothermal energy is when one drills down to the heat of the earth to either boil water or another fluid, bring it up, spin a turbine, and generate electricity. Northern California right now is about 25% powered by deep geothermal because it's got surface heat. Iceland is the same way. One of the things that I'm a big proponent of is to start some research to develop deep geothermal energy anywhere on Earth. There's unlimited power 10 miles from everywhere. That's what I would. But meanwhile, the power of the Earth is unlimited. It's uninterrupted, And MIT, the Department of Energy, Energy Research Lab, have all proved in studies that geothermal generates less electricity less expensively and less with less environmental impact than any other type of power.
If it's got all those advantages, what do you see as the biggest obstacle to more widespread use of geothermal?
The commodities industrial complex, the fossil fuel industry. They're getting $40 billion of subsidies a year. If we use that, we could put in 10 geothermal plants every year for 30 years or so, and we'd eliminate greenhouse gases altogether.
Vane, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Now for something completely different, I think. David in Hastings-on-Hudson. Hi, David.
Hey, Brian. How are you? I'm a longtime listener.
Thank you. What do you want to explain?
Well, I wanted to address folks' misperception or the fear of clowns.
Fear of clowns.
Exactly. I'm a clown myself. I'm what is called an eccentric clown.
In what context are you a clown?
In what context? Well, I'm a full-time family entertainer, so I do shows at private events, festivals, theaters all across the nation.
Okay.
Yeah, and basically, you know, I come up against this fear constantly. I do not wear the type of classic makeup that people are generally associated with frightening-looking clowns. But that comes from a tradition started by Ringling Brothers, actually. Traditionally, historically, circuses were only one ring, like the Big Apple Circus from New York. It's a very intimate space, and clowns never wore garish makeup like you see in those scary movies. But when Ringling Brothers started, they expanded the one-ring circus to three rings and 2,000 seats. The clown entertainers had to augment their makeup, change the makeup to make it look more, to be able to be seen in the back seats of the house, back seats of the tent.
So it was just broader makeup, but did they also take a stance of being scarier rather than just friendly or funny?
No, I think I think people's perception of clowns as scary comes from a couple of things. One, it's a Hollywood creation, and two, I think that there were performers who maintained this garish makeup, this broad makeup from the gigantic arenas, and then brought them into people's homes. So it was a perception issue where now you have this makeup for expressions to be seen from far away, right up close, and of course that's quite scary.
So what do you make yourself up to look like when you're working?
Sure.
And do you find that kids or anyone are afraid of you?
Right. No. Well, that's the thing. It's what I don't do the full clown face. I'm very pared down style. I do also shows that are. That are very recognizable themes, a pirate show, and other shows like that. And I don't have any real experiences of kids being frightened of me,
right.
Except if they're, you know, frightened of Captain Hook, and I'm doing my pirate show.
I hear you. And David, I'm going to leave it there, but that was fascinating. Some background on where fear of clowns came from. Grace in Wappinger's Falls. Well, we have a lot of expert people from the north, the north suburbs, right? We've had in a row, I think, Beacon, Wappinger's Falls is you, and Hastings-on-Hudson was the clown. So, hi, Grace.
Hi. I work in Hunter College and, of course, longtime listener of your show.
Mm-hmm.
I've been so excited to talk to you today about my issue, which is Governor Patterson's recent portrait hanging in the Hall of Governors. The article wrote that he had a walking stick seen in the portrait because he might need it one day. And I want to talk about the difference of walking stick and a long cane. Someone who is visually impaired, such as Governor Patterson, although he doesn't fully admit it, is better off with a long cane, one that you put out in front that clears your next step, you see. And in that way, you know if there's a drop-off, a drop-up, a step-up, an obstacle, something to trip you, and you can make, you know, appropriate adjustments in your path. Whereas a balance helper, like a walking stick, you know, if you don't see what's in front of you, maybe you will lose your balance, and that would help, but it's too late almost. Right?
So it's about the angle, it sounds like. The walking stick would be out
on
from you at a kind of 45-degree angle or something, whereas a cane is more vertical.
It's tricking your next step. So when you walk, you know you've cleared that and there should be nothing in your way, or if there is something in your way, it will find it. And if it's an obstacle, it will stop you from going forward. If it's a down, it'll stop you because you'll feel that right. elevation. But if it's only at your side, you don't know what you're stepping into.
Interesting.
So we
looked up, knowing what you were going to say, some articles about this cane in the portrait of Governor Patterson.
Okay.
And we see that leaning against the window in this shot, or this painting, I guess, is a cane topped with an eagle head. And Mr. Patterson is quoted saying, "So many disabled people feel diminished or insecure about the disability, so I wanted to put the cane in the picture to make it clear to everyone that I'm not running away from it." And so, for whatever it's worth, maybe they put the wrong kind of device in there, but he used the word cane.
Right. It's one of those things that goes way back. In fact, you'll have older adults coming for services who have reduced acuity, which is the leading cause for falls and serious injury and death in older adults. When they want a cane, they want that support cane. It's what has gone down in history as the right thing to do. And unfortunately, the long white cane has this sort of, it's for blind people only, and it's really not. It's a better use for someone whose vision no longer helps them avoid these dangerous obstacles, things that your vision can't do any longer. It still can do other things.
Grace, thanks for calling in. That was great. Nice to hear from you. And that's our Explanatarium segment for today. We could go on and on with this because there are so many of you who are expert in so many different things. So we will continue to do the Explanatarium from time to time here on The Brian Lehrer Show. If you feel like just continuing to post what you wanted to say, you can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have an Explanatarium page there for today's show. And Add whatever you like.